May it please the court. My name is Michael Zweibel, registration number 14376, and I represent John Todoroki, the defendant and appellant in this matter. Your Honors, in a criminal case, a violation of the statute of limitations is normally a jurisdictional bar to prosecution. In the statute at issue here, which is subsection 12 of 16-5-401, the legislature provided an exception to that rule for a number of things, but is relevant here for, quote, charges brought to facilitate a disposition. And the question in this case is exactly what the legislature meant by that language. It's our contention, and I think it's supported by both the language of the statute and the legislative history, that this was meant to be a very narrow exception, that it was meant to apply only to a new charge that is added for the purpose of disposition and is not contained in the original charging document. And it is not meant to apply to charges that were contained in the original charging document but were outside the statute of limitations.
What is a new charge then? What would qualify as a new charge?
It would be a charge that does not encompass the charges that were contained in the original charging document. And I imagine the court may be asking that because in this case what happened was there were five original charges and then they were consolidated into a single charge. And four of the five original charges were outside the statute of limitations because they had beginning dates that were more than 3 years before.
Well, isn't it more typical, though, that we might have a burglary and a larceny, and the burglary is, say, it's first-degree burglary, and what's the new charge becomes second-degree burglary. It facilitates the plea, but at the same time, it pertains to the very same circumstances. It's the same circumstance. How does this not apply?
Well, first of all, let me say that that's not the issue presented here. Here, the consolidated charge were exactly the same five charges.
Well, it might be, if I can interrupt you, Mr. Zweibel, sure. Perhaps you can explain to me, and maybe you're going here, and forgive me, why do we have this added sixth count that sort of consolidates some of the charges? I couldn't find in the record an explanation of that. Now, one explanation is Mr. Todoroki was not going to plead guilty to four felonies, so they reached a deal and said, we'll plead guilty to one and write a new charge. I mean, there was an amended count. So could you help me, as you're answering Judge Garparelli's question, could you help me just understand the facts here?
Sure, and I wish I could. I was not the trial attorney at either stage, either the original plea or the motion to withdraw the guilty plea. And as Your Honor notes, it's not in the record. And I can only surmise, as Your Honor did, that the nature of the plea bargain was that Mr. Todoroki at that time had agreed to have one felony on his record rather than a series of felonies. But nonetheless, the charge that resulted is exactly the same. It just incorporates all five charges, and it has a beginning date that is before the statute of limitations. Now, the question Judge Carparelli asked really has to do with really a lesser included. What happens when you plead to a lesser included?
Actually, my question is what constitutes a new crime or a new charge? Typically, we will have an offense stated, and we'll have an agreement that a plea will be entered if the existing charges are dropped, and if a new charge still pertaining to the same offense is added, and that's the deal, and it's a pretty quid pro quo. How is this situation any different? I mean, I understand your thing about it, a lesser included, but how's this any different? It pertains to the same offenses. It is part of the plea agreement. There's an agreement to drop and add. How is this substantively different, and how can we read legislative intent into it?
Well, I'll get back to legislative intent in a minute because I think that's probably the most interesting part here. But the question of when is a charge a new charge, I think really we have to look at the elements of the original charge. We can't look at whether it pertains to the same events, because obviously it's going to pertain to the same events. So the question does it mirror the elements, I think, of the original charge, which it does here, and which I think, speaking hypothetically to a situation that's not involved here, a lesser included would fall within that same situation. But for example, you know, back in my days as a public defender, we would very often get plea bargains where a defendant is charged with, say, second-degree assault or first-degree assault, and we end up pleading to menacing. Now, menacing in that case is not a lesser included. It doesn't mirror the charges of the second-degree assault or first-degree assault, but it does pertain to the same events. But I would say that would be a new charge. That would be something that was brought solely for the purposes of disposition. I think perhaps the distinction has to be is in part has to do with whether the defendant and defense counsel had a hand in crafting the new charge, rather than the charge having been crafted by the prosecution and then presented to the defendant and saying, here, plead to this. Because presumably in a plea bargain where a whole new charge is added, defense counsel would come and say, look, you know, we can't plead to this, but we would plead to a whole different charge. You know, we'll go ahead and plead to a whole different charge because it gives us certain benefits. And I think that's part of the distinction. And I think if I can talk about the language of the statute, that really is reflected in the language of the statute here. Because the language of the statute is charges brought to facilitate a disposition. What does it mean to bring to facilitate
disposition? Does it say new charges brought?
It doesn't say new charges. It just says charges brought.
So you rely, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Of course.
You rely on the Wilson case footnote 2.
I do, and I know Your Honor was involved with that.
Well, I was involved with Lowry that I think Wilson relied on. And Lowry was, of course, a lesser non-included, but not included brought by the defense.
Yes.
At a trial. So I think your definition would fit within the Lowry framework, but my question, you don't really have authority to say new, this means new, other than that footnote in Wilson.
Well, I don't have authority from the case law because it's never been addressed in the case law. None of the cases that were cited by the prosecution dealt with this situation. This is really an issue of first impression. What I do have is I have the language and the legislative history, and the language, I guess I'll just talk about that real briefly because I want to get to the legislative history. The language could have said, if defendant pleads guilty to a charge, that is a waiver. Could have said that by pleading guilty, that's a waiver, because that's one way to go, and that would encompass any disposition of any charge. But the legislature chose not to do that. They chose to bring to use language that says brought to facilitate a disposition.
So, now, sorry to interrupt again.
Please.
Well, what do you mean by brought? Define it.
Well, by brought, I mean a charge that is crafted for the purpose of disposition that is not included
in
the original charge. And one of the reasons I say that is because of the legislative history. What we have is this, this bill was presented to the legislature by Bill Ritter, who was then the Denver DA. And at that time, he was careful to say, he said, first of all, that this is a very tightly written, that was his language, very tightly written amendment. And he was careful to say that we, meaning the prosecution, we can't bring a charge that is beyond the statute of limitations. I've quoted that in the brief. However, if the defendant or defense counsel tenders, and this is his quote, a whole new charge, that's when this would apply. And I think that really that approach really comes from the fact that this is a response to the Verbrugge case, where it was the defendant who tendered the charge. And I think that's really the main concern here, is whether the defendant is the one who actively participates in creating or crafting this charge.
Well, don't we have at least, and I recognize the record is what it is, Mr. Zweibel, but I mean, here, just literally, we have a whole new charge. We have an added count 6. Presumably, the defendant was involved in negotiating a plea. And again, I recognize the record problem, so take it for what it is. But, you know, and maybe it's better for me to ask it as a hypothetical. If the case were, here that we know for a fact the defendant wanted to say, I'm not going to plead guilty to four felonies, but I'll plead guilty to one. And then they say, okay, what if we consolidate these and we do what they did here? Would that be, if you had that record, if the record was clear, would that be a new charge for purposes of the statute as you see it?
I don't think it would.
Okay.
Because all that would happen in that case is the prosecution, it would be the same as if the prosecution said, I'll plead to count one and we'll dismiss counts, you know, two through five. In this case, they simply consolidated all of them into one count. I think if the defendant had gone and said, I want one felony, and then the prosecution consolidates it all into one felony, obviously the defendant agreed to that by pleading guilty.
And that would facilitate disposition.
But it's not a charge that's broad. It's not as Bill Ritter would say, a whole new charge that's broad. And I think one of the concerns here is the legislature didn't want to go too far. And I think that's shown by, and I talked about it in the reply brief, there originally was language in this bill, lines 12 through 15, which said, unless the defendant raises the statute of limitations problem at certain stages of the proceeding, I think arraignment and maybe a couple of other stages, then there's a waiver as to the jurisdictional bar. And Mr. Ritter came to the legislature and said, in consultation with, I think, the public defender, we've eliminated that language because we thought it was too drastic. We didn't want to affect that kind of a drastic change to the existing law regarding statutes of limitations. And I think this is all of a piece with that the approach of solving only the Verbrugge problem and no more than the Verbrugge problem is exactly what they were trying to do here, rather than to somehow give permission to the prosecution to bring charges that are time barred if they can do it without anybody noticing by the time the defendant pleads guilty. And so I think that's why I say it was narrowly drafted. I would like to reserve some time because I suspect I'm going to hear that this is not a jurisdictional bar at all from the prosecution. I would like to have some time to answer that as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Kevin McReynolds, Colorado Bar number 40978 for the people. You know, I think this case does present an interesting question, but I think the only interesting question is whether or not the appeal should be denied on the merits for the application of the statute, or whether or not it should be basically dismissed because by pleading guilty, he gave up the right to even bring in the first place. Now, factually, yes, so the guilty plea here was he was originally charged with five counts of theft, one per each victim. A different charge of theft was brought regarding all of the victims. He pled guilty to that charge, and the prosecution dismissed the other six. This is precisely what the General Assembly meant to cover with the facilitated disposition language in the statute of limitations, subsection 12.
So now, let me interrupt.
Go ahead.
So you would agree that 12 only applies to new charges? It's your position this is a different charge that he pled to?
I would say it is a different charge. So it's clearly within the language. I do not think it needs to be new. Really, what I think, jumping forward for a moment to try to answer your question, what the defendant's argument is really two different steps. He's saying, based on the plain language, brought means it has to be something different than the original charges. I think that's a really aggressive reading, and I think the legislative history is actually contrary to that. I think one could plead guilty to one of the original charges, and it would fall within the language of the statutory exception. But that's not our issue anyway.
Well, explain how.
In the statutory history, he relies very heavily upon the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing. In that hearing, Governor Ritter is at no point discussing the facilitated disposition portion of subsection 12. He's discussing only the Verbrugge. He's discussing only the fact that lesser included offenses brought by the defendant will fall within this exception because They, by making, by bringing such charges, they've waived them. Now, in the earlier hearing, in the House Judiciary Committee, Governor Ritter did address the facilitated disposition. And the original language was that it shall not apply to offenses brought at the request of the defendant to facilitate the disposition. And they struck that language, and he explained when they were striking it that that language is intended to give flexibility for facilitated disposition. That means plea deals, plea bargains. And it's best to strike that language because really it doesn't matter which party is bringing the charge that we're all agreeing is going to dispose of this through a guilty plea. And in practical terms, it would usually be the prosecution that was doing that anyway. Now, at no point during that discussion does he even suggest that it has to be a totally different charge.
If I can interrupt you, I'm sorry, Mr. McReynolds. Let's look at the statutory language, though, and take the hypothetical. In this case, if Mr. Todoroki pled guilty to one of the five original charges.
Right.
Now, I think what you just told us was that could still fit within the statute.
Yes.
But I don't see how that would be the language, a charge of offense brought to facilitate the disposition of a case. It wasn't. It was brought at the beginning of the case. Yeah. So what does that mean? If it has to be brought, I recognize the word new is not there, but it has to be brought to facilitate the disposition.
And I don't really have any, there isn't really anything out there that solidly addresses that other than, you know, if it is ambiguous, look to legislative history. What does, when they're originally discussing the amendments to the statute,
well,
what do they say?
Sorry to interrupt.
Go ahead.
I mean, your reading, if I understand it right, would kind of render anything other, once you plead, once there's a guilty plea, we're done with statute of limitations arguments.
I think that's
because anything that's charged or anything that is added as new is the exception to the general statute. So if he pleads to count one that was originally charged, I mean, anytime there's a plea of guilty, is that your position?
It is my position, and what Wilson actually said, and if I could quote, it, we conclude the plain language of subsection 12, evinces the General Assembly's intent not to apply the statute of limitations to offenses to which a defendant pleads guilty. That's precise, that's an exact quote, and it's actually what happened in Wilson because he pled guilty to an amended version of the original count. And that was obviously upheld.
But an amended version would be a different charge than the original charge.
It would be. And again, I think.
And it relied, again, like I said to Mr. Zweibel, it relied on Lowry, which was also a new count, a new charge.
Absolutely. Again, the only thing I've found, I've obviously researched this rather extensively, is the legislative history regarding the amendment, regarding that it has nothing to do whether the defendant participated in crafting that charge that he pled guilty to, that it was designed to provide flexibility for guilty pleas. And it is to address more than just the Verbrugge question. The Verbrugge issue was just the lesser included, not included. And obviously, by having something about guilty pleas, the exception goes further than that. No, go ahead.
Bustamante seems to suggest that you're outside the statute, you're done. I mean, that's a summary. So if you're going to base a plea on a charge that falls outside the statute of limitations, there still may be a problem with that. So you have to bring a new charge. I mean, is there a way to... Am I reading that wrong?
The reason I disagree with you, Your Honor, is because while Bustamante could have previously been read to address the subject matter jurisdiction of the court and was interpreted as that, after subsection 12 was passed, that is no longer the case. Because subsection 12 makes the statute of limitations subject to the consent of the parties. It makes the statute of limitations waivable by the defendant by, you know, pleading guilty, by asking for a lesser included or lesser not included defense that is outside the statute of limitations. And by addressing Verbrugge, which had relied on Bustamante and said, our hands are tied. this charge was barred by the statute of limitations. It's a matter of subject matter jurisdiction. That's no longer the case. And really, the reasoning from the Supreme Court's McMurray decision shows why the statute of limitations cannot be treated as a matter of subject matter jurisdiction any longer. Because the key characteristic that that case involved the speedy trial statute. And after objecting to a violation of the speedy trial statute, the defendant pled guilty. And the Supreme Court said, and again I'm quoting, the key characteristic of subject matter jurisdiction is, quote, it can neither be waived nor created by consent of the parties. And based on that, they concluded that because the speedy trial right, that statute, is waivable, it is not a matter of subject matter jurisdiction. And that conclusion was reinforced by the lack of anything explicit in that statute saying that it was taking away the court's general jurisdiction of constitutional authority. And the frank incongruity of having this statutory right elevated above even fundamental constitutional rights. You could not in any way, if it was a matter of subject matter jurisdiction, you could not ever give up that right. But you can, by pleading guilty, give up your right to counsel, give up your right to appeal, give up any number of additional rights, fundamental constitutional rights. And in fact, that's the incongruity that in jurisdictions that didn't have such an active legislature that responded to Verbrugge as it did. The D.C. Circuit was one of the first cases that sort of affirmatively reject, case was United States v. Wild in 1977, reject the jurisdictional view of the statute of limitations. And it did so because of the incongruity of having the statute be unwaivable, be unable to be given up, whereas fundamental rights could be. And the same reasoning, you know, obviously would apply here, because there is an incongruity of having the statute of limitations defense be more important, be of a higher regard than any other fundamental constitutional right. Now, I fully admit that that is how Bustamante has been previously interpreted. I don't think it can be interpreted that way anymore because the addition of subsection 12 and the reasoning of McMurray show that it cannot be a matter of subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, let me ask you, and I think maybe, and I fear getting into a semantic debate here. Jurisdiction can mean several different things, and
Absolutely. You
both kind of address that.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my question is, does it matter in this case? I mean, there are cases out there that talk about subject matter jurisdiction. The court doesn't even have the power to hear this thing from the get-go.
Right.
And I think the other side of it, the argument you're making seems more persuasive to me, that if this is not, it's not subject matter jurisdiction, but it's still a matter of jurisdiction.
Yes.
Meaning the court doesn't have the power to convict a guy, to have the trial on something that's late, for example. But it doesn't mean that you have no shot here at making your argument that you waived it, you can't even appeal. And my problem is Bustamante says that. I mean, Bustamante says you can raise it any time. So we can fight all day long about whether it meant subject mm-hmm. matter jurisdiction or not. And I'm sure Mr. Zweibel will address this in his 2.5 minutes when he gets up. But to me, at least from your position, I don't understand why they're out of court. Even if we say it's jurisdictional, whatever Bustamante means by jurisdictional, the one thing Bustamante is clear about, it says, we disagree that it's just an affirmative defense, and you can raise it any time. So that's the argument you want us to say, is you can't raise it any time. And I'm not persuaded, frankly, and I want you to try to persuade me.
Okay, I'll try to explain that. At the time Bustamante came out, by using that language, it can be raised any time. I think it could properly, at that time, be interpreted as a matter of subject matter jurisdiction that can be raised at any time. But once subsection 12 was passed, once they made the statute of limitations clearly a waivable, clearly something that is subject to the consent of the parties, it is no longer a matter of subject matter jurisdiction. And McMurray had essentially the same argument being made, which was there had been some previous case law talking about the statute as jurisdictional. And so the Supreme Court directly addressed it and said, yes, we did use the word jurisdictional.
Yes, that does have to do with the authority of the court to act. But that's different than subject matter jurisdiction. And the reason it mattered in McMurtry, like it does here, is the defendant there pled guilty. And by pleading guilty, you give up almost all ability to raise an appeal. One of the very few exceptions to that is if you're appealing an issue of subject matter jurisdiction. By finding that the speedy trial right did not implicate an issue of subject matter jurisdiction, that meant that he had no right to make that, to appeal that issue after pleading guilty. That's the exact same situation we have with the statute of limitations here. Even if you disagree with me on both points, you find that you should interpret the statute of limitations exception as you can't plead guilty to anything that relates in any way to the original charges, and it has to be against different parties, it has to be different charges. Even if you agree with that, this case still fails on its merits because none of the charges were barred by the statute of limitations in the first place. Here, the statute of limitations for theft under subsection 4.5, it's quote, shall begin to run upon discovery. That's not an exception to the statute of limitations. That's what the statute of limitations for theft is. It's defined not by exceptional terms. And it's different from the language that the legislature used when addressing exceptions to the statute of limitations, like the fugitive exception, which is now the absence from the state exception in Colorado, used, it shall be told. It's however the statute originally was, it's going to be different now. It does not include, it shall be extended. None of those are the situation here. And given that he agreed to the factual basis for his plea, and in that agreed to the information contained in the discovery, there's no fact that suggests that the statute of limitations actually was violated.
Do you agree that it's a new or reasonably should have known standard for the victims? The statute starts around the new.
Okay, absolutely.
So you discuss at length very powerfully that the victims, it really wasn't disputed, the victims didn't know until whatever date and were fine.
They had the accounting, yes.
What evidence in the record is there about when they reasonably should have known as opposed to when they knew?
I don't have anything more than, obviously, it's a limited record, and it's a limited record because he pled guilty here,
right?
Which obviously raised the inequity of giving him the right to, you know, befuddle the record and then claim that, oh, there's no record to support it. But in any event, he agreed to plead guilty, he agreed to the facts as stated, and I see my time is up. I ask that this court dismiss the appeal because it does not involve an issue of subject matter jurisdiction, or alternatively, affirm his guilty plea below. Thank you.
Your Honors, first of all, I just want to say that it's obviously not correct that any guilty plea waives the jurisdictional bar imposed by the statute of limitations. It's not what the statute says. It's not what Wilson says. Wilson says this guilty plea waived it because nobody raised the issue of whether new charges whether the statute should only apply to newly brought charges. So citing Wilson, I think, does not answer this question. And the reason a guilty plea doesn't waive jurisdiction, a guilty plea to an original charge doesn't waive jurisdiction, is because the court didn't even have jurisdiction to take the guilty plea. The court wasn't supposed to be, you know, the defendant wasn't even supposed to be there in the first place because the court has no jurisdiction. And so the court had no jurisdiction to take the plea itself to an original charge. And that's what Verbrugge held. And that part of Verbrugge was left untouched by subsection 12. And it's not true that subsection 12 all of a sudden has made the jurisdictional bar something other than a matter of jurisdiction or subject matter jurisdiction. That's not what subsection 12 says. Subsection 12 creates an exception. And you don't have to create an exception to a rule that doesn't exist. They created an exception to the jurisdictional bar for very narrow circumstances, thereby recognizing that the jurisdictional bar exists.
But doesn't that mean we get to hear the case? Because if as I understand your theory, it's subject matter jurisdiction, the court couldn't even take the plea, couldn't do anything. If that's the case, we don't need an exception in subsection 12. We'd never get there because it's always totally barred.
Well, except that subsection 12 says that when you add the new charge, that waives the defect, that the original defect.
But under, and I really, I just want to make sure I understand. But how do we get there if the court never can, don't you know, jurisdiction have a hearing? How does the court even consider that?
Because subsection 12 says that when you plead guilty to the newly added charge, that waives the original defect.
So that, as, where does the jurisdiction of the court come from? Does 12 create jurisdiction that didn't exist before? Subject matter jurisdiction?
Well, apparently it does, because there's no other way to get there. Otherwise, the court wouldn't be able to hear it in the first place.
So the defendant enters into a plea agreement while the court has no jurisdiction, and by entering into the plea agreement, he confers jurisdiction on the court. And of course, defendants can't confer jurisdiction. It is the legislature that confers jurisdiction.
Yes.
Let me, Mr. Zweibel, you know, one test that we always have to apply is common sense. And it appears to me that this makes no common sense. And perhaps you can help me here. Had this case gone to trial, there would have been a finding with regard to the discovery date and the statute of limitations if he had raised that issue. But he chose not to go to trial, and he chose to stipulate in a sense with regard to the facts and circumstances of discovery. And so, whereas had he pled not guilty and it had been proved in the trial, his conviction would stand, but because he admitted his guilt, the conviction should be reversed.
Well, first,
it doesn't make any sense.
First of all, if this had gone to trial and nobody had ever said anything about the statute of limitations, it wouldn't matter what the evidence showed, because under Bustamante, following trial, for the first time on appeal, Mr. Todoroki could come to this court and say everything has to be dismissed because the court never...
He could raise the jurisdictional issue. So let's talk about Bustamante. Bustamante was up on a writ of prohibition, and of course we don't have that anymore. And second of all, on the writ of prohibition, the people in Bustamante had the opportunity and would have had the opportunity here to present their case, why the case was not barred by the statute. So there would have been a hearing on the application of statute, even under Bustamante. But you're telling us that because Bustamante said we can take this on a writ of prohibition, that it is within our power as a Supreme Court to hear the matter, that suddenly now we must interpret it as, regardless of any hearing, it's jurisdictional, and therefore there never was. I don't follow the, you know, I don't follow how somehow under Bustamante the people never get a hearing on this issue.
Because that is the way Bustamante works, unfortunately, but you know, for the prosecution.
Why does Bustamante work that way? In Bustamante, the people got a hearing. But now you're telling me under these circumstances they don't.
But in every case since Bustamante says the court did not have subject matter jurisdiction. And they do use the term subject matter jurisdiction, by the way, regardless of the prosecution's argument. They say, therefore, the court could not have proceeded on this, and we're issuing...
They heard the evidence on it, didn't they? It was a writ of prohibition.
But I think the, you know, it's the responsibility of the prosecution to not bring charges, to either not bring charges beyond the statute of limitations or to plead an exception on the face of the document, just as it is the prosecution's obligation to only charge things that are crimes. That's why we say when an offense is not charged in the information, the court has no jurisdiction. And it doesn't matter whether there was ever a hearing on it. You can raise that for the first time on appeal. And if it doesn't charge a crime, and there are cases like this, then it's void. And the convictions are void and vacated, regardless of whether the prosecution had a chance to have a hearing. Because the question is not whether they had a chance to have a hearing. The question is whether they properly charged the crime in the first place, which is their responsibility. And
that Bustamante, you say, says all of that?
No, I'm saying that Bustamante, well, Bustamante certainly implies all of that, mm-hmm. but that all of this, all of the cases that talk about the fact that the court does not have jurisdiction when a criminal offense is not charged, is based on that premise. And I think I cited some of them in the brief, mm-hmm. where they say, you know, look, if a crime is not charged, the court has no jurisdiction. And it doesn't matter whether you lay in the weeds and wait till later and surprise prosecution. We're now arguing that the court had no jurisdiction. The cases say, you know, that's okay.
And let me
if
go
it's
back.
Not okay, then
I'm quite confident you won't agree with this analysis. But it seems to me that under Bustamante, the court first had to decide, is this jurisdictional? Because if it's not jurisdictional, we cannot take it on a writ of prohibition. So they said it is jurisdictional. Then they heard the merits. And had they heard the merits and concluded, it would appear, they could have concluded either that it was barred by the statute or it wasn't. There doesn't seem to me to be any inexorable thing that under Bustamante, just because it is sufficiently jurisdictional to be heard under a writ of prohibition, therefore there was a lack of jurisdiction. But is that your interpretation, that under Bustamante, therefore there is a lack of jurisdiction?
Well, I think that's exactly what Bustamante says, and frankly, every division of this court that has looked at Bustamante since then has said that. And I cite some of the cases. I would hate to think they were all wrong. Bustamante, the reason I disagree with Your Honor's analysis is because Bustamante doesn't say, we've heard the evidence and we've concluded as a factual matter that these offenses lie outside the statute of limitations. They say, we've taken this up on a writ of prohibition and we looked at the face of the complaint. And on the face of the complaint, there is a date that is outside the statute of limitations. And unless on the face of the complaint an exception is pled, the court has no jurisdiction. And they would not have had to engage in that analysis if they had said, we've heard the evidence, and as a factual matter, in this case, we think it lies outside the statute of limitations. So that.
And so then later under Bowen, when they said, but of course you can amend.
You can amend before trial, I believe.
Okay, you can amend before trial. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll accept this case now as submitted for decision. We will issue an opinion in due course. Thank you, counsel. That was very helpful, very interesting and involved analysis.